Today on Ag News Daily.
The challenges we face today are they're not completely different from what we've had in the past. I mean, farming has always relied so much on the weather.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and happy Friday here on the Ag News Daily podcast. My name is Delaney Howell, joined by our summer, or I guess it's not summer anymore, well, still technically summer, but our school intern, Madison Honkamp. Madison, do you know what the actual first day of fall is? I'm not sure I know it off the top of my head.
I think it's September 23rd, October 20th.
I think it's in September.
It's like September 23rd or something, or maybe 21st. I'm not sure.
Okay, well, it's coming up. Fall is coming up. It's right around the corner.
Yes, it definitely is.
It definitely is. Well, we have a good conversation coming up with Zach Youngquist of Youngquist Ag, looking at some ag tech stuff as well as what the crop is looking like in Illinois. But before we get to that, Madison, do you have any news for us for today?
Well, Delaney, one bigger thing that I saw today was the EPA is now going to be required to look at the effects of biofuels on different wildlife species. They are having to consult with different federal wildlife agencies on the impact of its 2018 rule setting for renewable fuel targets in D.C. So obviously this is going to be something that we're going to be watching, but the court kept the rule in place but remanded it to the EPA in order to determine effects on threatened and endangered species. So we'll see how this plays out.
Yes, absolutely. So a little bit more background news on that, or background to that story, because I have that as well. The D.C. Court of Appeals was basically ruling on a couple of different factors, including the 2018 blending requirements under the RFS, and it ordered the agency to go back and conduct an Endangered Species Act review as well. And then, as you mentioned there, it found that they concluded that basically all the challenges to the RFS lacked merit except for the one that the EPA has violated its obligations under the Endangered Species Act by failing to determine whether the 2018 rule may affect endangered species, whether that renewable fuel standard may affect endangered species. So we will watch how that one continues to chug along here. But really, I think the big takeaway here is they did not make any challenges to the blending requirements. But it seems that the Trump administration is getting ready to make some sort of announcement here over the near future to mitigate some of those concerns over small refinery exemptions, according to AgriPulse. And apparently they have received details of this deal, which include language to include a 500 million gallon, the 500 million gallons called for in the 2017 court case, and an additional 500 million biofuel mandate compliance credits to be used in the 2021 blending target. So I think essentially what they're saying there is we could see basically up to $1 billion more included in blending targets for the 2021 mandate.
Yes, definitely. And I know one thing that they really touched on with the EPA is they've seen lots of different errors with these blending requirements, but they haven't really gone to correct them. And I think that's kind of the bigger thing that they really want to focus on with this.
Yes, I think that you are spot on the nose there, Madison. What else is jumping out at you today?
Well, Delaney, there was one thing. I know poultry has kind of been in the news a lot with the price fixing and wage fixing lawsuit going on right now, but we could see poultry possibly going into the U.S.-UK trade talks, obviously if negotiations ever pick up with agriculture again. But one issue has been chicken, because the UK doesn't really like how we process chicken. The American practice, so to speak, is washing the chicken carcasses with chemicals to kill pathogens like salmonella and E. coli. and it is known as a pathogen reduction treatment, but it is banned in the EU. So that's kind of that we need to find a way around that almost if poultry really wants to be in these trade talks. And one other thing that they really emphasized on was they don't like that Americans don't really buy any British beef, lamb, or even haggis from Scotland. And so this is, again, something we'll have to be watching. But I believe August 31st is kind of their goal for trade talks. To either pick up trade talks or see where they want to go.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, a little bit more on that, too. Basically, Vice President Mike Pence has been meeting with leaders of the British Parliament to get a trade agreement there with the UK as soon as possible. We know Brexit is still a little bit of the hold up there, as well as some of those other issues, Madison, that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go back to a point you made there about haggis. Madison, do you know what haggis is?
Yes, it's gross. It sounds disgusting.
Do you want to share for us what it is?
It's actually the national dish of Scotland, which I did not know. It's in this article that I'm reading. And it's they call it a pudding that's made from a sheep's heart, liver, and lungs. And it's all, like, stuffed into the small intestine.
It's like a pudding pie. Right. I think it's like a pudding pie of basically the sheep's innards cooked.
Yeah.
Or I think it's cooked into like a shepherd's pie almost. But honestly, if people in the U.S. are already having issues eating like normal products like hamburgers and beef and they're turning to alternative meat sources, I don't think that haggis is going to be high on consumers' list.
Yeah. I really don't think we're going to see haggis coming into the United States. If it does, it might be staying on store shelves for a little while.
I would say so, Madison. But one thing that has not been staying on store shelves, especially in China, has been pork. We, of course, have seen the largest surge of U.S. exports to China from the U.S. In July, we saw a record 233,242 metric tons in July head out to China despite the ongoing trade war. But this is an interesting tidbit of news here. The U.S. Dairy Export Council, who's, of course, run and led by President and CEO Tom Vilsack, said that they have been continuing a dialogue with China, talking about how whey protein not only helps kind of fill that void in the time when pork is at extreme highs over there in China, but also accelerating the repopulation of China's hog herd. According to Vilsack, he said that research shows that feeding this whey protein to lactating sows can accelerate the repopulation of their hog industry, and that's also used pretty widely among babies and some of the elderly. It's a great source of protein, he says, and it's also a great source of protein to help get some of those hog herds repopulated. And he said they're basically sharing this information with the Chinese in an effort to continue along the good faith there and help provide some support for the U.S. during the ongoing trade talks. So I thought that was an interesting little piece of news there.
Yes, it definitely is. But so with this, how does it increase repopulation, I guess. That's interesting.
I am not 100% sure. I'm not a scientist, obviously. But he said it's helping, it helps with the lactating cells, so maybe it helps them lactate better, faster. I'm not sure. I'm going to have to do a little digging to figure that one out.
Maybe helping like the piglets grow faster? Is that what they mean more of?
Possibly. Yes, that very well could be the guess there, Madison.
Possibly. I don't know.
It sounds right-ish.
Yeah. Somebody let us know. Tweet us, Facebook us.
Yes. Yes, please do all of those things. But looking at really other meat exports too, poultry, that's been a big one. Pork's been a big one. But even beef exports have held relatively steady during the past couple of months. And over year here, they've risen 1% from this time last year. And we're at over 117,842 metric tons. But pork exports up 32% from year over year in July. So we are starting to see the demand of pork pick up in China. It just maybe hasn't been this huge flood that we thought originally was going to head over to China. It's been more of a trickle effect instead, it seems.
Yes, definitely.
Madison, what else is jumping out at you today?
Well, Delaney, I'm actually all out of news for today.
Well, Madison, let's take a look at where those commodity markets closed for today. There's lots of red on the screen, even after some positive news yesterday with continued trade talks. It didn't seem like that was quite enough news to pick up the grain markets. Starting off here in the September corn contract, down 4.25 cents to end the day at 3.42 and a quarter. The December contract cut 3 cents to end at 3.55 and three quarters, nearing some of those contract lows we set earlier this year. In the September soybean contract, they also cut 4.25 cents to end at 8.45 and a half, while the November cut 4 cents to close at 8.57 and a half. In the wheat pits, the September contract lost 4 cents today to close at 4.60 even, while the December contract down 2.5 cents to close at 4.63 and three quarters. Hopping over into the livestock pits, not a pretty day for the live cattle. The October contract was almost limit down at $3 to close at 94.87 and a half. The December contract down 2.47 to close at 99.75. In the feeder cattle pits, the weakness continues with the September contract cutting $1.05 to end at 133.35. The October contract cut $1.42 to end at 130.90. In the lean hog pits, the October contract shed $2.80 to close at 63.50. The December shed $3 to close at 62.47 and a half. And in the dairy markets, they were the only winners for today's markets, with the September contract closing up 6 cents to end at 17.96, the October up 8 cents to end at 17.71. Now, as promised, we're going to have a great conversation today with Zach Youngquist of Youngquist Ag. For today's Fri-Yay episode, I'm joined by Zach Youngquist of Youngquist Ag out in Illinois, central Illinois there. Zach, thanks for joining me this Friday.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me, Delaney.
So, Zach, tell our listeners a little bit about Youngquist Ag and your background, kind of how you got your start in the field.
So I myself am a fifth generation farmer. I'm in my early thirties. We've been farming, like I said, five generations. My father has been selling Pioneer seed for the majority of my lifetime. And when I came back from college, in 2009, I kind of took over my grandfather's side of the farm and started working with my dad. He had a precision planting aspect of the Pioneer seed operation that I took over, and then I managed that for several years as well as farmed. Kind of came into the seed business, a couple years later, and then we, Dad and I together, spearheaded mostly by me, got into chemical sales and fertilizer sales as well as custom application. And we have a consulting arm as well that we have been working with growers on. We've turned it into a fairly large independent retail operation here, still maintaining the Pioneer seed brand, and really trying to provide that extra assistance to the grower. So that's kind of how we've come to be, and I don't think there'd be any other industry that I would enjoy my job as much and want to be in. So,
yeah, and fifth generation that's a pretty good chunk of time to have continuous farming families. So that's really exciting, really neat for your family.
For sure. Yeah, it's it's in our blood. My first word when I was born was bombine, combine, obviously. So I think I'm doing the right thing that I was meant to do. I don't think that would be any different. So
Zach, tell me a little bit about some of the practices that you're using on your farm, and then what are you consulting with farmers? Since obviously, maybe when your great-great-great-grandparents started farming, you're doing things a little bit differently than what they did on their farm. So what challenges, what practices are you using to adapt to today's day and age?
I would say, the challenges we face today are they're not completely different from what we had in the past. I mean, farming has always relied so much on the weather. So, you know, everything that we do, we're not only able to change a little bit, but that little bit that we can change, you know, the tools at our disposal is a vast majority more today than there was even 10 years ago. From a technology standpoint, from technology, equipment, all the above. When I came back to the farm, we were pretty heavy, ripping and a lot of tillage done on the farm. Grandpa was really big into that. You know, he loved spreading, a lot of fertilizer every year. You know, really, that was kind of his mentality. Well, you can't ever spread enough. And I came into the mix seeing that there were some, opportunities, finding different ways to potentially, grow the crop. And that was, through strip till. We stopped the chisel plowing and the heavy tillage practice, and bought a Krauss Gladiator running dry fertilizer in the row at a reduced rate ahead of the corn crop. And we actually, we bought an Airway as well as another machine that we use in the farm side, for lots of reasons, you're able to create a layer of good water absorption, running that Airway and you're still able to mix the soil up a little bit without creating that compaction layer you do with most of your other tillage tools. And we do that ahead of our corn on corn. We're pretty heavy continuous corn. And those are the kind of things that we've changed a little bit when I came back. And one of the biggest things that I like to focus on, and one thing that we've taken to our growers, which I do believe, kind of sets our business apart from the rest, is just the amount of time and dedication that we spend on those acres. There are so many different things out there that, farmers get from a retail perspective or a technology perspective. It's really hard for them to have the decision-making confidence in this rapidly changing and evolving ag environment. That decision-making confidence, I think, weighs pretty heavy on them, and it's hard to have that insight and clarity, true clarity into what they're doing, the decisions they make every year. And I think us being on the acre as often as we are really does help, set that apart and, give them some of that confidence.
Zach, explain to me a little bit more what you mean by that, getting confidence in the decisions that they're making. Do you mean the way that they're taking their data, or do you mean the people that they're surrounding themselves with?
A little bit of both. We have so much technology today where we have oodles and oodles of data. It's easy to get yield maps. It's easy to get soil maps. It's easy to get what you sprayed where, all those different things. But it's hard to interpret it. It's how you use the data. I mean, there are so many companies and growers and retail agencies alike that do a lot of this work, but it comes down to actually evaluating that data. And, that confidence in the evaluation is where you have to go that extra mile, because everyone farms very differently. There's no one size that fits all. And a lot of companies try to push that one size fits all attitude, and it does not work. And, our consulting arm, which we call ROI Advisor, it's based in just that ROI. And, yield does not parallel profit. It never has. Yeah, it's cool to punch out those big, big bushels, but, if you've spent another $60 to make another $50, that doesn't make much sense. And the evaluation of the data you get off of that ROI analysis, it farmers are they're very bright individuals, and a lot of people don't give them the credit for that, the abilities they genuinely have. And I feel that when you provide that extra layer of assistance, whether it's actually being in the field with them and truly focusing on that ROI more than just yield, they'll start to see that, and their confidence in that will grow, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it does. So, Zach, let me ask you this then. I'm challenging you today on Friday, but what do you think then is the solution for growers who have all these companies, they have all these options, they have all this data available to them? How do they, what's their next step to make sure that they're not just being maybe passive farmers, so to speak?
It's the next step is, That's a hard question. Thanks, Delaney. I would say really it's that independent consulting ability. So, you know, we have, you know, all these companies are great. You know, I would say Pioneer has phenomenal agronomists that we work with. These guys are brilliant. You know, there's lots of people out there who are genuinely trying to help you be a better farmer. And I think one thing that gets lost a lot, and one thing that farmers need to do a better job maybe interpreting, is the guys who genuinely are out there trying to make them better, and then the guys who are genuinely out there, you know, trying to just kind of push a sale, you know, this looks really good on paper, and move it forward. You know, in today's day and age, a farmer needs to be better at, you know, interpreting who's doing what, and the guys who are out there, you know, the guys who really care, the genuine, the agronomists, the people who have that, you know, that knowledge and insight well above and beyond my own abilities even, those are the guys you need to really, you know, be spending the most time with. Because there are lots of things that we see every year, you know, like this year, for example, the way the crop went in, everyone said doom and gloom, there's no way we're going to raise anything. Well, the USDA has a pretty big number out there. And unfortunately, there is quite a bit of corn out there.
Yeah.
How did that happen? You know, we go to next year after this year and the years we've had in the last few, you know, where we just had phenomenal yields. And do we really evaluate how it happened, or do we kind of forget about it and just go back to our status quo? Changing that status quo, and it's hard. I mean, farmers in general don't like to change. You know, we're a pretty stubborn bunch. You know, we do what we do because mm-hmm. it's always worked, and it has worked. There's so much longevity in it. But I think that extra evaluation on what really does make the difference is, and that's your ROI at the end of the day. So I guess I kind of jumped around the question maybe a little bit.
I think that makes sense. I especially like the status quo. I think that makes a lot of sense. But Zach, since you kind of led us into that, talking about this crop year in particular, we've got to know, we've got to get an update. You're there over in Illinois. How are crops looking in your part of the state, and how are crops looking as you've traveled maybe around the state a little bit in consulting?
I would say, you know, we had Western Illinois, we had a pretty dry spell there, longer than most, and actually we're kind of in drought mode there for a minute. We got some really timely rains to kind of help this crop finish out that we needed desperately. I mean, we also were the ones who got the most April corn planted. So that April corn, while it is variable, where it's good, it's really, really good. It's as good as it has been in the years past, but there are a lot of holes out there, and the variability is extreme. You know, the checks that I have done pretty extensively the last several weeks, you know, you're talking yield checks in the range from, you know, 60 bushel to 280 bushel in one field. And, you know, that combine pass is going to vary by 100 bushel from side to side. So trying to actually do a yield like what the USDA comes out with, I think, seems to be pretty difficult. However, we have gotten a lot better at packing in weight, packing in the bushels. The last several years, you know, hybrids have a lot of flex to them these days, and, you know, it's hard to count that depth and that extra weight. So, you know, when the USDA comes out with a number that's lower or high, we wonder how that's possible. Well, you know, a lot of that has to do with the hybrids of the day. And it's just, but, yeah, extreme variability, Delaney. all over the board. June planted corn does not look as good as the April stuff. And it's just, it kind of depends on when you got the rain there, especially for that June planted corn.
Yeah, and I think this year is just going to be so interesting to see if it's possible to just kind of grow ourselves out of a weather market, so to speak, if we've got the technology in place. I think this year is going to be the year to be like, well, we've got drought-resistant technology, and it looks like the technology that we have in place with our seeds and hybrids is also water, or, you know, during the wetter years, also maybe a little more hardy to that, too. So I think this year is going to be quite an interesting one.
No doubt. And going forward, you know, if we are able to raise as large of a crop as we have, and then, say, next year and the year after, we can get back to raising what we have in the last few years, you know, this whole ROI aspect is going to come into play even larger than it has as in the recent past. You know, we're burning through working capital, you know, not quite like we did in the 80s, but it's not super far from that. And we need to do a much better job of evaluating, you know, what cash rent farms are. Are we farming those extra acres because we just want to farm those extra acres? So is that actually making us money as a whole operation? Probably not in a lot of circumstances. And, you know, the thing is the tools that we're doing with our growers and using, you know, Ag Solver, you know, basically breaking out profit by zone, by field. You know, what do you do with those zones that have been unprofitable for year over year over year? I mean, can you do something different? Can you reduce your inputs there? You know, how do you truly evaluate those areas that are losing you money? Because ultimately we're going to have to get rid of those areas that are losing us money, especially in this tight climate that I think is going to get even tighter.
Absolutely.
Going forward.
Yeah, so. It's a pivotal time in agriculture, that's for sure. Zach Youngquist, thanks so much for joining me today.
Okay, thanks a lot, Delaney.
All right, well, again, a big thank you there to Zach Youngquist of Youngquist Ag. I tell you what, Madison, this growing season is going to be an interesting one, and folks, we want to hear from you. We want to stay in tune with you, what's going on in your fields. Madison, how can they do that? How can they share that information with us?
Well, Delaney, listeners can always find us on the web or on social media, I guess I should say, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Ag News Daily and at Global Ag Network. We'd love to be able to share photos and share, you know, what people are doing, how they're contributing to the industry, what's going on in their operations, and all of that fun stuff. But, Delaney, if they want to get caught up on past episodes, maybe while they're in the field or in the barn, they can always find us at our website at globalagnetwork.com/agnewsdaily, as well as on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, really anywhere you can find podcasts.
Absolutely. Or you can always check out any one of the other fantastic podcasts that we have right now on globalagnetwork.com. They're always uploading new episodes as well, so do check those out. Madison, with that, should we let the people go?
Let's let them go.